We resume our chapter number 9, Sankhya Yoga and Vedanta. We're a bit of the way into it. Sri Aurobindo is distinguishing that Prakriti is not the same as Maya, as interpreted by a much later Vedantic tradition. Nature in the Gita is ultimately seen to be a deliberate manifestation of the divine, governed and controlled by the Supreme Person in all the details of its working. So it cannot ultimately be a field of falsehood, of illusion, nor can it remain forever in ignorance. It has a divine origin, and if the universe has a destination, then the divine must have plotted for itself a felicitous journey. We begin with this sentence. Still, whatever the precise distinctions of their metaphysical ideas, the practical difference between the Sankhya and Yoga, as developed by the Gita, is the same as that which now exists between the Vedantic yogas of knowledge and of works, and the practical results of the difference are also the same. The Sankhya proceeded like the Vedantic yoga of knowledge by the buddhi, by the discriminating intelligence. It arrived by reflective thought, vichara, at right discrimination, viveka, of the true nature of the soul and of the imposition on it of the works of Prakriti through attachment and identification. Just as the Vedantic method arrives by the same means at the right discrimination of the true nature of the self and of the imposition on it of cosmic appearances by mental illusion which leads to egoistic identification and attachment. In the Vedantic method, Maya ceases for the soul by its return to its true and eternal status as the one self, the Brahman, and the cosmic action disappears. In the Sankhya method, the working of the gunas falls to rest by the return of the soul to its true and eternal status as the inactive Purusha, and the cosmic action ends. So in either case, you see, if it's Purusha withdrawing from Prakriti, there's cessation of the world for all intents and purposes. And if the soul in Vedantic scheme is no longer bewildered and wrongly identified with an egoistic formation and recovers its true isolated being, then it plunges back into the infinite, and the universe, which never really was there, is altogether gone. The Brahman of the Mayavadins is silent, immutable, and inactive. So too is the Purusha of the Sankhya. Therefore, for both, ascetic renunciation of life and works is a necessary means of liberation. But that is as we come to know Sankhya, and that is as we come to know Advaita Vedanta. The Vedanta of the Upanishads, the original Vedanta, is quite different, and the Sankhya that we meet in the Gita is not the same as what has just been depicted. And Sri Aurobindo continues, but for the yoga of the Gita, as for the Vedantic yoga of works, action is not only a preparation, but itself the means of liberation. And it is the justice of this view which the Gita seeks to bring out with such an unceasing force and insistence. An insistence, unfortunately, which could not prevail in India against the tremendous tide of Buddhism, was lost afterwards in the intensity of ascetic illusionism and the fervor of world-shunning saints and devotees, and is only now beginning to exercise its real and salutary influence on the Indian mind. And I think much credit should be given to Sri Aurobindo. His reinterpretation of the Gita, you might say it's restoration to what plainly the language of the Gita says to us, has been noted by many people across India. I have to tell you that the Sri Ramakrishna Mission, which does not often refer to Sri Aurobindo, for decades sold essays on the Gita as the only commentary which they would provide to their readers, because it is so excellent. And, of course, Sri Ramakrishna was not an integral yogin. He was not calling people to join life and actively fulfill the world in terms of its spiritual possibilities. But the mission as a whole greatly honored and still honors Sri Aurobindo for this. It isn't simply Buddhism. It's a kind of a shorthand. There was a movement in Indian spiritual history when renunciation, what we call the Shramanic movements, capitalized on social, political, economic disparities in the few centuries leading up to the Common Era and then afterwards, such that to get away from what was apparently a world of division and suffering, the best answer was the pure life of the ascetic, the aspiration to withdraw from the world and plunge into a realization which took you out of all this considerable contagion and put you square into a state of realization where you're beyond all things that might touch you. There's a footnote here. At the same time, the Gita seems to have largely influenced Mahayanist Buddhism, and texts are taken bodily from it into the Buddhist scriptures. We may therefore have helped largely to turn Buddhism, originally a school of quietistic and illuminated ascetics, into that religion of meditative devotion and compassionate action which has so powerfully influenced Asiatic culture. Well, you can go to our website, and there are a couple of talks, I think, still posted there, which describe the arc of Buddhism in India. And the older school, Theravada, followed by Mahayana, which referred to Hinayana. Mahayana means the great raft. And Mahayana regarded Theravada, the original school of Buddhism, as far as we can tell, as being the little raft. Why? Because Theravada Buddhism took Buddha's last words, you might say, seriously and said, work out your own salvation. In other words, focus on yourself, get liberation yourself. What can you do for another if you have not yourself been lifted out? If you have not yourself experienced nirvana, then how can you liberate another from samsara? Mahayana, the larger school, had as its standpoint, you could put it in an apothegm, I will refuse, says the Bodhisattva, to accept enlightenment for myself until every sentient being, every blade of grass has accepted enlightenment, has won enlightenment before me. This is a great statement. This is vast. This means that all must be delivered before. I will not accept. It's a tremendous motivation to serve, to come back and eliminate, alleviate suffering upon the earth. The two together, of course, have seen their own schools populate much of Asia. Theravada, of course, is dominant in what we used to call Burma. And the Mahayana schools went to China and Japan, developed into Chan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. All aim at extinguishing suffering. To come back to Sri Aurobindo's point, to affirm the world is natural to Vedanta, original Upanishadic Vedanta, which the Gita takes up and furthers. Because this world is again a manifestation of the one Supreme Being, not adventitious, not accidental, a deliberate manifestation, and all of that Supreme is discoverable in this manifestation, though it seems only to be a part and a fraction of that, with a capital T. That may have a name, may be seen as a conscious being, may be experienced as an immensitude that cancels all categories. But this world, in the original Vedanta, is not absent reality, is not absent worth. But we cannot get lost in mere formation and mistake the form for the reality behind. We have to become deep enough, broad enough, wise enough to be able to dwell in the thing of the moment and never lose the vastness of that which is eternal. Be always seated in that, stationed in that. So to get there, we have to be free of the form in some essential sense. So back to Sri Aurobindo's interpretation of the Gita, which overturned, you might say, millenniums of misreading, taking it simply as an allegory, taking it as something which faints in one direction but leads really into another. Sri Aurobindo says, no, the language of the Gita is very plain. You are here now because not only is your soul conjoined to this task, which has been appointed to you, but the divine himself, herself, itself joins you, has missioned you forth for this very moment. And you cannot refuse. It is cowardly to say no. Back to Sri Aurobindo's essay here. Renunciation is indispensable. And again, he means true renunciation. Tyaga, the inner release, not sannyasa, the outer renunciation, but tyaga. Renunciation is indispensable. But the true renunciation is the inner rejection of desire, and egoism. Without that, the outer physical abandoning of works is the thing unreal and ineffective. With it, it ceases even to be necessary, although it is not forbidden. You see, if you drop desire and egoism, you essentially attain the prospect which Buddhist practice gives you. You're no longer identified with the fiction. Now you're free of that. Knowledge is essential. There is no higher force for liberation, but works with knowledge are also needed. By the union of knowledge and works, the soul dwells entirely in the Brahmic status, not only in repose and inactive calm, but in the very midst and stress and violence of action. This puts to us the question, what is peace? Is peace merely the absence of commotion, of violence, or is peace something more? Devotion is all important, but works with devotion are also important. By the union of knowledge, devotion, and works, the soul is taken up into the highest status of the Ishvara, to dwell there in the Purushottama, who is master at once of the eternal spiritual calm and the eternal cosmic activity. This is the synthesis of the Gita. It's a summary statement, and it takes us till the 18th chapter of the Gita, one realization piled upon another to reach that elevation. And in our practice too, we likely are going to attain union with the divine, either through communion of works, through the practice of offering, or through identity attained through adoration, or through knowledge, by penetrating the veils and getting to the essence behind, all of which lead to the One. Or we can be one with the One in all simultaneously, which is what the Gita prescribes for us at the end. That is when we attain the status of identity with the Supreme Person, Purushottama. But apart from the distinction between the Sankhya way of knowledge and the yoga way of works, there was another and similar opposition in the Vedanta itself. And this also the Gita has to deal with, to correct and to fuse into its large restatement of the Aryan spiritual culture. This was the distinction between karmakanda and jnanakanda, between the original thought that led to the philosophy of the Purva Mimamsa, the Vedavada, and that which led to the philosophy of the Uttara Mimamsa, the Brahmavada, between those who dwelt in the tradition of the Vedic hymns and the Vedic sacrifice, and those who put these aside as a lower knowledge and laid stress on the lofty metaphysical knowledge which emerges from the Upanishads. Purva means east, or what is in the front. Uttara means what is above, what follows. Kanda means stalk, stem, branch. So karmakanda and jnanakanda are branches of one thing, really. They come from one tree of knowledge. The one deals with the Vedic riks and the rituals associated with them, and the other deals with the deeper knowledge, which is metaphysical in thought, but which is spiritual in experience. For the pragmatic mind of the Vedantins, for the pragmatic mind of the Vedavadins, the Aryan religion of the rishis meant the strict performance of the Vedic sacrifices and the use of the sacred Vedic mantras in order to possess all human desires in this world, wealth, progeny, victory, every kind of good fortune, and the joys of immortality in paradise beyond. So this was the typical understanding. We did the ritual, we offered the sacrifice, we uttered the mantras from the Veda to get worldly goods. They weren't aiming through these rituals at attaining oneness with the Supreme inwardly. For the idealism of the Brahmavadins, this was only a preliminary preparation, and the real object of man, true purushartha, began with his turning to the knowledge of the Brahman, which would give him the true immortality of an ineffable spiritual bliss far beyond the lower joys of this world of it, or of any inferior heaven, purusha, artha. So in other words, the aim of the man. If you're looking for a reference point in the Gita, as close as you'll find is chapter 18, shloka 34. And not directly there. Whatever may have been the true and original sense of the Veda, this was the distinction which had long established itself and with which, therefore, the Gita has to deal. Of course, we know that Sri Aurobindo felt that there was an inner side to the Rig Veda which was not patent to the uninitiated. He deals with that in his writings on the secret of the Veda. But here we're interpreting the Veda according to how the Gita views it, which is simply rituals undertaken, rituals which were works, religious works undertaken to achieve the good things of life. But the Gita aims at a spiritual life beyond the mere good things of life, but does not cancel out the good things of life too, but insists that you must get the essence, otherwise you get lost in the noise of life as commonly lived and met. Almost the first word of the synthesis of works and knowledge is a strong, almost a violent censure and repudiation of the Vedavada. This flowery word which they declare who have not clear discernment, devoted to the creed of the Veda, whose creed is that there is nothing else, souls of desire, seekers of paradise. It gives the fruits of the works of birth. It is multifarious with specialities of rites. It is directed to enjoyment and lordship as its goal. This is in the second chapter, shlokas 42 and 43. There is a hint here, of course, that the keepers of these sacred mantras, these rituals, is the class of superior humans called the Brahmins. And of course, this teaching of the Gita occurs in the context of the Mahabharata, which is telling in epic terms, literally, the lives of the Kshatriyas. And the Kshatriyas, the great warriors, have their own schools of wisdom, Raja Rishis, etc., King Janaka, etc., etc., let alone Krishna, my God, literally. So there is a bit of a poke here. But it's not that the Vedas are completely contemned. It's just this externality of the Vedas, this false identification with the merest surface of human life that it rejects. So let's keep going. The Gita even seems to go on to attack the Veda itself, which, though it has been practically cast aside, is still to Indian sentiment intangible, inviolable, the sacred origin and authority for all its philosophy and religion. Remember, he's talking about the there and then. At the writing, the composition of the Gita then, it's viewed, the Vedas are not viewed as living engines of great life. Nobody knows what they mean anymore. The Upanishads have come into being, in a sense, to recapture what the inner essence of the Veda was and condense it, boil it down to language they could get, and hence the Vedantic teachings. Also remember that the Upanishads, all of them, arise out of refuges, hermitages, that have been established by kings for the sages just outside their precincts. Instead of in the cities, the forest hermitage of the sages is where the rishis, the sages of the Upanishads, dwell. But they're hosted, in a sense. They're taken care of by the kings. So it's there that if there is a continuity of Vedic teaching and bringing it from a forgotten age forward into the current age and then to be transmitted to a following age, it's through the grace of the Kshatriyas that this occurs. The action of the three gunas is the subject matter of the Veda. But do thou become free from the triple guna, O Arjuna? Chapter 2, Shloka 45. The Vedas, in the widest terms, all the Vedas, which might well include the Upanishads also, and seems to include them, for the general term Shruti is used later on, are declared to be unnecessary for the man who knows. The Shruti is the revealed word, obviously. But for the person who lives in the spontaneity of the essential truth, even the word is unnecessary. If you're there, nobody needs to guide you there. You don't need words to take you there. As much use as there is in a well with water in flood on every side, so much is there in all the Vedas for the Brahman who has the knowledge. That's a beautiful image. Two, 46. Nay, the scriptures are even a stumbling block for the letter of the word, perhaps because of its conflict of texts and its various and mutually dissentient interpretations, bewilders the understanding, which can only find certainty and concentration by the light within. When thy intelligence shall cross beyond the whirl of delusion, then shalt thou become indifferent to scripture heard, or that which thou hast yet to hear. Gantasi nirvedam shrutavyasya shrutasya cha. When thy intelligence, which is bewildered by the shruti, shruti vipratipanna, shall stand unmoving and stable in samadhi, then shalt thou attain to yoga. Chapter 2, Shlokas 52 and 53, for all that. So again, samadhi means unmoving, dwelling without perturbation in the essence of being. So true being is true consciousness. There you are, if you are. So offensive is all this to conventional religious sentiment that attempts are naturally made by the convenient and indispensable human faculty of text twisting to put a different sense on some of these verses. But the meaning is plain and hangs together from beginning to end. It is confirmed and emphasized by a subsequent passage in which the knowledge of the knower is described as passing beyond the range of Veda and Upanishad. Shabda Brahmarti Vartate, 6:44. So this is tremulous to the scholar who wants to reconcile all of these things, because how can the Gita take such a mighty stand and throw to the floor the sacred Veda, the sacred words? Because it commands from inside and from above a larger territory of the real. Let us see, however, what all this means, for we may be sure that a synthetic and Catholic system like the Gita's will not treat such important parts of the Aryan culture in a spirit of mere negation and repudiation. Synthetic because it brings various pieces back together into a whole. Catholic because it's wide like the universe. The Gita has to synthesize. Aha, again, the correct use of the verb in English. The Gita has to synthesize the yoga doctrine of liberation by works and the Sankhya doctrine of liberation by knowledge. It has to fuse karma with jnana. It has at the same time to synthesize the Purusha and Prakriti idea common to Sankhya and Yoga with the Brahmavada of the current Vedanta, in which the Purusha, Deva, Ishvara, Supreme Soul, God, Lord of the Upanishads, all became merged in the one all-swallowing concept of the immutable Brahman. And it has to bring out again from its overshadowing by that concept, but not with any denial of it, the yoga ideal of the Lord or Ishvara. So all of these statuses, the inner reality of the Purusha, that which dwells divinely in you, the individual, Deva, one of the shining lights governing cosmos and universal reality, Ishvara, a supreme Lord beyond all of these merged into the idea of the Brahman, or Parabrahman, if you prefer, but finally resolved into the Ishvara, and we'll see one step more. It has, too, its own luminous thought to add, the crown of its synthetic system, the doctrine of the Purushottama, and of the triple Purusha, for which the idea is there, no precise and indisputable authority can be easily found in the Upanishads, in which seems indeed at first sight to be in contradiction with that text of the Shruti, where only two Purushas are recognized. So, a step beyond, what is it that reconciles all? A third status, a larger personhood, which folds into its own being the immaculate, undetermined, infinite of sheer Brahman, that which is timeless and spaceless, that which is pure sheer being, and the multitudinous universe, multiform, inhabited by limitless numbers of Purushas, all of them divinely sparked out from its own central fire. Somehow, these three stations, the kshara, the moving, the akshara, the unmoving, and the ultimate, the purushottama, are one being. The Vedanta, in terms of the Upanishads, hints at this. Shvetashvatara, even sections in the Chandogya, later in other Upanishads, Katha as well, but nowhere chalked out in clarity as we find it in the Bhagavad Gita. Moreover, in synthesizing works and knowledge, it has to take account not only of the opposition of yoga and Sankhya, but of the opposition of works to knowledge in Vedanta itself, where the connotation of the two words, and therefore their point of conflict, is not quite the same as the point of the Sankhya yoga opposition. It is not surprising at all, one may observe in passing, that with the conflict of so many philosophical schools, all founding themselves on the texts of the Veda and Upanishads, the Gita should describe the understanding as being perplexed and confused, led in different directions by the Shruti. Shruti Vipratipanna, again, 253. What battles are even now delivered by Indian pundits and metaphysicians over the meaning of the ancient texts and to what different conclusions they lead? He's writing now in the present. Well, it might have been 1917 or 18, but it's still true here in 2022. The understanding may well get disgusted and indifferent. Gantasi Nirvedam, chapter 2, shloka 52. Refuse to hear any more texts, new or old, Shrutavyasa, Shrutasya cha, and go into itself to discover the truth in the light of a deeper and inner and direct experience. I think we will put our bookmark there. Since I am so breathless that I can't pronounce Sanskrit, it must be time to stop. Let's see, if you have patience a moment more, let's see if we can read some of Savitri, section that's pertinent to this, goes to Savitri's search for spiritual truth, where she arrives in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 6, Nirvana, and the All-Negating Absolute, at a particular experience which will be meaningful to you. We begin on page 546. A pure perception was the only power that stood behind her action and her sight. If that retired, all objects would be extinct. Her private universe would cease to be. The house she had built with bricks of thought and sense in the beginning after the birth of space. This seeing was identical with the seen. It knew without knowledge all that could be known. It saw impartially the world go by, but in the same supine unmoving glance saw too its abysmal unreality. It watched the figure of the cosmic game, but the thought and inner life and forms seemed dead, abolished by her own collapse of thought. A hollow physical shell persisted still. All seemed a brilliant shadow of itself, a cosmic film of scenes and images. The enduring mass and outline of the hills was a design sketched on a silent mind and held to a tremulous false solidity by constant beats of visionary sight. The forest, with its emerald multitudes, clothed with its show of hues, vague empty space, a painting's colors hiding a surface void that flickered upon dissolution's edge. The blue heavens, an illusion of the eyes, roofed in the mind's illusion of a world. The men who walked beneath an unreal sky seemed mobile puppets out of cardboard cut and pushed by unseen hands across the soil, or moving pictures upon fancy's film. There was no soul within, no power of life. The brain's vibrations that appear like thought, the nerve's brief answer to each contact's knock, the heart's quiverings felt as joy and grief and love, were twitchings of the body, their seeming self, that body forged from atoms and from gas, a manufactured lie of Maya's make, its life a dream seen by the sleeping void. The animals lone or trooping through the glades fled like a passing vision of beauty and grace, imagined by some all-creating eye. Yet something was there behind the fading scene. Wherever she turned, at whatsoever she looked, it was perceived, yet hid from mind and sight. The one only real shut itself from space and stood aloof from the idea of time. Its truth escaped from shape and line and hue. All else grew unsubstantial, self-annulled. This only everlasting seemed and true, yet nowhere dwelt. It was outside the hours. So this is Savitri in the Sylvan Fields, outside Satyavan's hut, where she dwelt with him. But the inner picture described here refers to Sri Aurobindo's own realization in 1908. And I misread a line. I'm going back to page 546 to read it correctly. Roofed in the mind's illusion of a world. Namaste, Jaima. Mm-hmm.